I have a message from another time. Airy Productions Unlimited presents Undocumented Features Future Imperfect Symphony of the Sword No. 5 Suite for Trinity and Avatar, the Dicho Suite. Third Movement, Goodbye and Hello as Always, by Benjamin D. Hutchins, hi, that's me, and Philip J. Moyer with Anne Cross. Thursday, March 18th, 2410. Air Temple Island, Dicho. Corwin Ravenhair woke up, but remained perfectly still, because he knew exactly where he was. The room where he lay was dim but not dark, the daylight outside diffusing softly through medium-weight window blinds, and silent but for the soft and pleasant sounds of those who had not yet awakened. Corwin didn't even bother opening his eyes at first. He'd have to do that soon enough anyway. Right now, he was just going to savor the unique combination of being conscious of his situation and not actually needing to be yet. On some level, he had expected many things about the night that had just passed to be difficult, or awkward, or logistically complicated beyond his fatigue and stress-diminished capacity to cope with them. In practice, though, it had all just been really quite nice. There had been frequent interruptions for routine maintenance, sure, but it was still one of the best night's sleep he'd had in ages. He wondered idly whether, the cosmos being an inherently perverse place, that meant there was something wrong with him. If so, he decided, the hell with it. Let it be wrong. If it was wrong to enjoy lying here in this pleasantly cool, dim space, wrapped up in bison wool and warmth and love and subtle scents of roses and cinnamon and human beings, Corwin was reasonably sure he didn't want to be right. Presently, the person to his right, technically in front of him, since he'd turned onto his right side at some point, stirred and made faint waking noises. He knew without looking which she would be, from the sounds and the flatness of the belly under his left hand. But he opened his eyes anyway, for no better reason than that he wanted to watch her open hers. This Utna Tenjo did a moment later, blinking awake with something just short of a start. Corwin watched her clear blue eyes focus on the unfamiliar ceiling, her face assume a demi-frown of thoughtful concentration as she considered it. Then she blinked again, turned her head toward him, and smiled. "Corwin," she said quietly. "Good morning." "Morning, Elsker," he replied, kissing her gently. Ushna's smile became slightly wry, but also slightly dreamy, as she lay her head back against her pillow again. "I don't think I'll ever get tired of hearing that," she said. "That's good," Corwin agreed, "because I plan to keep saying it for some time." "Get a room, you two," Anthi Tenjo mumbled from the far side of Ujna, but when she raised her own head, she was smiling at them both. "Good morning, High Priestess," said Corwin cordially, moving his hand to place it on her arm where it crossed Uchina's chest. "I trust you slept well?" "Astonishingly well, my pillar, considering," Anthi replied. "Okay, the formality is creeping me out a little," Utna observed. Anthi chuckled and gave her a kiss. "Be patient with us, my love. It's only the second time we've woken up together." Utna would have replied to that, but before she could do so, there came a soft sound from the cradle next to the bed, alerting the three that the newest and smallest member of their household was awake as well. 3/4 of an hour or so later, everyone was sorted out and ready to face the day. Showered and dressed, Utna went and opened the blinds, flooding the room with daylight and revealing another lovely day in Yue Bay. Standing by the sink in the ensuite with the door open, Corwin finished tending his beard. This, in its neatness, was considered a slightly weedy attempt by many of his maternal relations, but he was simply not up for growing the full grisly atoms, even if either of his ladies would have tolerated it, which he sincerely doubted. For their part, Anthea and Annabel went back to bed, together, now that they were the only ones in it. "So," said Utina, "plans for the day?" "Well," said Anthea, "you two should get to breakfast. Annabel and I will stay here today, I think. She's likely to have a busy enough day without us venturing to the dining hall. Besides," she added with a smile, "call me old-fashioned, but I think when a woman has given birth, she's entitled to spend the next day in bed if she likes." Utina laughed. "I wouldn't presume to argue that," she said, remembering vividly the ordeal she'd watched her lover endure the night before. Anthea had bounced back from it amazingly. Utina expected that if she had gone through an experience like that, she'd still be a mumbling wreck the next morning. But here was Anthea sitting up in bed all bright-eyed and cheery, plainly just taking it easy because she felt like it, rather than because she had no choice. It was a thing to be marveled at, and Utina did so as she bent and kissed her. After a moment's hesitation, she did the same to Annabel's forehead, lightly. She thought the infant looked pleased about that, but she couldn't really tell. Anthea's smile was a little bit gentle, as she squeezed Utina's hand and then let her go. Their instant's eye contact was all she needed to convey her understanding of that hesitation, that Utina was still working on getting her head around the very concept that their family now included a baby daughter, and that Anthea had faith in her adaptability. For his part, Corwin seemed to have no trouble with that. He kissed his daughter first, and then her mother, before he and Utina took their leave, promising to return straight away after breakfast. "You're taking to this incredibly well," she observed to Corwin as they made their way down the hall. Taking his hand as they walked, she laced her fingers with his and added, "I figured you'd be a little shell-shocked today. I know I am." Corwin squeezed her hand. "All my panic's on the inside," he assured her. Then, less flippantly, he added, "Though actually, yeah, I feel pretty good. I mean, I wasn't sure how I'd react, and I think I'm still loading a bunch of the software patches, but overall, not as unready as I expected to feel." He grinned wryly. "That'll probably change as soon as something doesn't go exactly right." Utina laughed and kissed his cheek. "Don't be so sure. I've seen you handle a crisis or two before, remember? You're going to be awesome at this dad thing," she said. "So are you," he replied, making her laugh again, as he pushed open the exterior door with his free hand. They had gone perhaps 5 paces beyond the front door, down the front steps and onto the path toward the refectory, when it suddenly dawned on them both that they had just passed a pair of colorful figures. Pausing and turning as one, they were faintly surprised to discover Maki and Izumi, still fully kitted out in their old-fashioned Kyoshi warrior's dress gear, standing at parade rest on either side of the door. As Corwin made eye contact with her, Maki smiled very slightly, but otherwise didn't move, like one of the famously impassive Chelterine Legion guardswomen outside Queen Azrael's palace on Seleucia. Backtracking to regard her closely, Corwin said, "Have you guys been out here all night?" "Of course," Maki replied. "Why?" "For the honor of the regiment, my lord," Maki replied stolidly. Corwin eyed her dubiously. "Maki," he said. Maki held the stone-faced pose for a moment longer, then smiled, becoming much more human. Taking her cue from her commander, Izumi relaxed at that point as well, letting a smaller smile come to her own face. It's a traditional first night courtesy for the children of royalty, Maki explained, giving Utena a wink. Normally, here on Air Temple Island, they have the White Lotus sentries for that kind of thing, but this was a special occasion. Well, said Utena, grinning back, I think regimental honor has been satisfied, Commander Maki. Come on and have some breakfast with us, and then you guys can get some sleep. I won't put up a fight about that, said Maki, having to stifle a little yawn now that she'd stopped holding herself rigidly expressionless, and the four of them set off for the dining hall. The building Corwin and Utena had just left was the last surprise they had received in their surprise-filled previous evening. They had vaguely expected, when Cora came to help them relocate from the Air Temple Infirmary's birthing room to some more suitable sleeping quarters, that they'd be taken to a room in the quarters usually used by the married air nomads when their endless travels brought them to the island. In the event, though, Cora and Iki had conducted them not to the married airbender's quarters, but instead to the big house by the pond, where once Iki's father and his family, including the now aged master herself, had lived. After her parents' passing, Iki's elder sister Jinora, the air nomad's grandmaster, had lived there for years, until her own children were grown and gone, after which she'd moved to the smaller quarters in the air temple itself, where she still dwelt. Though no one had lived in Tenzin's house, as everyone still called it, full time since then, the acolytes had maintained it meticulously all the while, as part of their regular upkeep of the whole temple complex. After the fashion of everywhere else on the island Corwin had ever seen, it was a Spartan but beautiful and welcoming place. He was surprised that Jinora had given Iki and Cora permission to bring them here, given the powerful attachments it must have for her, however much her airbender philosophy taught her to release such things. He hadn't been sure they'd all be quartered together, even tonight. He was still not entirely certain how Jinora felt about his oddball domestic situation. At his questioning look, though, Iki only smiled and told him, When a powerful enough wind blows, who tries to resist it is a fool, Corwin. Your family is a curious one, but there is no doubt in Jinora's heart now, after seeing you all challenge this great unknown together, that you are one. Then, to his fatigue-fogged surprise, she'd kissed him chastely, but not on the forehead or cheek, and then gently propelled him through the front door after Cora and the now three Tenjas. Go and be with them, with Her Highness's blessing and with mine. Good night, Corwin. Grandmaster Jinora was, coincidentally enough, the first person Utena and Corwin saw when they entered the dining hall, followed by Iki and their two brothers, all of whom rose from their seats at the head table and led the air acolytes and the younger airbenders in a round of applause. With a blushing smile, Utena held up a hand as if to fend them off. No, please, really, we didn't even do anything. Speak for yourself, Corwin murmured to her as they took seats by Caitlin and Cora at the usual corner table. I did plenty. Your part was months ago, Utena replied, and frankly not that challenging. Maki snickered quietly, as did Cora and Kate over their morning tea, having overheard them. Utena grinned at Maki while Corwin went a little red and mumbled something about that not having been what he meant. They were late for breakfast, and most of the temple's regular denizens finished and left shortly after they arrived. Cora and Kate stayed with them, lingering over their tea and chatting, while Corwin and Utena accustomed themselves to the strange notion that not everything in the world might be about the momentous happenings of the previous evening. When they finished eating, they packed the Kyoshi warriors off to bed with grateful thanks for their gallant gesture and hugs for their friendship, then headed back to the house. Jinora met them as they emerged from the dining hall. Ujna wondered whether the airbender's grandmaster had been waiting for them, or had artfully arranged her morning's rounds so they would bring her by this spot at the precise time she calculated they'd be coming out. She suspected the latter. The former was far too inefficient for Jinora. Corwin, Prince Tenjo, said Jinora, saluting them. A moment, if I may. Ujna smiled. Sure, but please, call me Ujna. We don't need to be so formal, and besides, I'm really only Prince Tenjo when I'm in Sephira. Jinora smiled slightly. Surely the owner of a truly princely heart is a prince wherever he, or she, happens to be, she said. But thank you, Ujna. I wonder if you think Anthy would be willing to receive visitors shortly. Iki and I would like to call upon the four of you. Ujna and Corwin glanced at each other, then turned back to Jinora. I don't think she would mind, Ujna agreed, nodding. She was pretty chipper when we left for breakfast. And as for Annabel, Corwin added with a grin, I think it might be a little too early to expect an opinion from her. Jinora chuckled. Indeed. In that case, Iki and I will be by in, let us say, an hour's time. We'll see you there, said Corwin. As the elderly airbender walked away, he turned to Kate and said, How about you? Ready to meet your niece? Of course, said Kate with a smile. They were about halfway back to the house when Corwin's Omnitool phone rang, the generic old-fashioned phone ring it made when someone was calling for whom he hadn't set a special ringtone. Corwin raised his hand to look at the caller ID, then grinned and keyed open the link. Hey, Rio, he said. So listen, Corwin, said Rio Sato, skipping straight over any introductory small talk. I was just over in Min Min's office, and some guy from the Tribune had slipped past security and was trying to get her to speculate on whether she thought you were going to, and I quote, take our avatar away from us. Now, pardon my Kokugo, but what the honk, son? Corwin blinked. Do what now? He said. That's what I said, Rio replied. Wait a second, guy from the Tribune, not a woman? Now don't you go believing my sister when she says I can't tell the difference, said Rio mildly. Okay, fine, said Corwin. Gotta level with you, Rio. I don't even know what that means. Yeah, well, neither did Min Min, Rio replied. Not that the guy from the Trib was prepared to take that for an answer. I had to show him out before she put a serious hurt on him. She was starting to get that twitchy eye thing going on. You know what comes after that? Shocky, shocky time! I don't have any idea how I might have managed to cause that, but I'm sorry about it anyway, Corwin mused. Listen, can you guys get out to Air Temple Island later on? I can apologize to Minami in person, and there's somebody here I want you both to meet. A couple of somebodies, actually. But certainly, young man, Rio replied jovially. We'll be out as soon as I can pry my beloved sister's talons from the corners of her desk. Ta-ta! Corwin closed the connection, then gave Cora a mystified look. Arching an eyebrow, she shrugged as if to say, Beats me, man. And they all continued on their way. They arrived back at the house to find that Anthea and Annabel were already entertaining guests, in the form of Cora's distant relative Karana, her professional bending partner Azana, and Anne Cross, who was Azana's student in firebending and Caitlin's in swordsmanship. When Corwin, Ujna, Kate, and Cora arrived, Karana was bending over the bed to conduct a cheerfully one-sided conversation with Annabel, while Azana stood by a trifle awkwardly, and Anne watched her with a crooked little half-smile. Getting a bit crowded in here, Cora observed. Maybe I better come back later. Don't be silly, Cora. Anthy chided her. You're Annabelle's godmother. Your presence is never going to be a problem for her. Besides, she added with a wry little smile, this isn't a particularly boisterous gathering, however many of us there are. She turned the smile to her infant daughter and added, we're all reasonably low-key at the moment, hmm? Cora's grin was a little sentimental as she crossed to the bedside. Okay, she said. Besides, I have to get back to town, said Karana. So you can take my place, Gran-Gran, she added with a wink. Eh, I oughta, Cora mumbled, half-heartedly flourishing a fist. Karana laughed, hooked an arm around the Avatar's shoulders, and gave her a squeeze, then turned her loose and said, bye, all. It's been real. Come on, Pabu. See you at practice this afternoon, Princess? Huh? Oh, sure, said Izana absently, as if jarred out of a reverie. Later, Karana. Karana eyed her faintly puzzled-looking partner skeptically, but declined to say anything. Instead, she tagged Utina's shoulder on her way past, kissed Corwin on the cheek, and bounded out of the room, Fire Ferret on her shoulder. Suspected morning person, Amy Pond observed as she passed Karana coming in. Glancing back over her shoulder down the hall, the Scottish redhead added without rancor after a moment's reflection, I think I hate her. Aw, don't hate Karana, she's awesome, Anne chided her. Where's Dr. Pond? Still sleeping it off, said Amy with a grin. So, any news from Eggland? Sitting in the corner with his feet up on the iron-banded chest containing his Aunt Matilda's egg, Noll shook his head. Nope, nothing. Amy's grin slipped slightly. Looking a little concerned, she crossed to him and crouched by the chest as he took his feet off it. I hope nothing's wrong, she said. Nah, she's fine, Noll replied. Then, with a sardonic smile, he added, she just won't come out. Claims it's too cold right now and she's waiting for summer. Amy blinked at the chest, then at him. Are you messing with me now? She asked. I am not, Noll replied cheerfully. Believe me, Mrs. Williams, when I'm messing with you, you'll know. He patted the chest. What are you two talking about? Azana wondered as she and Anne approached. Who won't come out? Noll turned to regard her, then got that twinkly-eyed look Amy remembered from the train. You want to see? He asked her. It's pretty good. At Azana's puzzled nod, he produced the key, unlocked the chest, and swung it wide. May I present my cousin? Name is yet unknown, he said, patting the faintly glowing surface of the egg. Azana arched one perfectly shaped eyebrow at him. Your cousin, she said. Noll nodded. Daughter of my father's sister, he said. Then, drawing himself up grandly, he went on, Matilda the Red, most dreaded dragon in Jotunheim. Azana didn't quite snort derisively, she was far too well-bred for that, but she looked as if she might have wanted to. Instead, she said slowly, Your father was a dragon. Yep, Mom, too. That's more or less how it works, Noll explained patiently. Anyway, Little Red here, she is supposed to be Annabelle's childhood companion, like I was for himself over there, he added, gesturing to where Corwin sat on the edge of the bed. But evidently she is none too pleased that our girl was born in March and not, say, August. Despite our careful packing, he gestured to the bed of hot coals in which the egg was nestled. She insists she's not coming out until it's at least 20 degrees warmer. Azana eyed him. And you know this because... She told me, We're telepathic in the shell, Nall said. With each other, at least. It's how we find out where our eggs are, once the dreaming is over. I'm completely lost now, Azana admitted, mostly to Anne. Okay, short version, said Nall. Dragon eggs aren't like, you know, turtle duck eggs. They don't hatch after a set time. Someone, usually one of the parents or a dragon priest, sets certain magical conditions on them when they're laid. They develop for a year and a day. After that, the dragon inside is fully formed, ready to take on the world. Only if the conditions haven't been met, we don't hatch. Instead, for however long it takes for our eggs to be ready, we roam the astral. You guys would say the spirit world. We learn things, language, history, our culture, from the spirits of our ancestors. We call that phase the dreaming. Whenever the conditions that were originally set on our eggs are met, which could be anything from let's give it 6 months to hatch when the dynasty is threatened, the dreaming ends. We wake inside the shell, check with anyone who might be outside, and if we think it's safe, out we come. He rolled his eyes at the red egg. Usually. Azana turned to Anne. Do you believe anything this young man is saying? She inquired, sounding genuinely curious. Anne smiled. I've been to his homeland, she said. I even met his uncle Bahamut, the Dragon King. She nodded to the chest. I was there when Bahamut gave that egg to Corwin. Azana looked her student straight in the eye for several long seconds, her face impassive, and Anne looked right back at her, unflinching. Truth be told, the hardest part about that wasn't not flinching, it was not blushing. Then she nodded with a fair enough sort of expression, turned back to Nall and asked, "Would a little extra heat help?" Nall looked puzzled for a second, then grinned. "Right! Duh! Firebender!" He stepped away from the chest and gestured to it. "Be my guest. I mean, worst case, you're not going to do any harm, as long as you don't set the house on fire," he added wryly. Azana gave him a sardonic smile. "Please," she said. "I am a professional." She squared herself up to the chest, closed her eyes for a moment in concentration, then struck a firebending stance and thrust both hands forward, playing a concentrated jet of orange-yellow fire over the surface of the egg. The eggshell's dull red glow brightened, then began to shift to orange. Azana's eyes flickered questioningly to Nall. He nodded, so she kept it up, keeping the flame carefully confined to the space within the chest's opening as she stepped up the intensity a little more to a pure sunlight-like yellow-white. And the egg cracked, with a sound like a rifle shot, drawing a startled cry from Annabelle. While her parents reassured her, the others drew nearer to look. Azana cut off her stream of fire and withdrew her hands, then took a handkerchief from her pocket and mopped the sweat from her forehead as she, like the others, watched the single crack in the glowing eggshell grow and branch out, spreading in crackling, percussive jerks as the dragonet within hammered at the weakened shell. "Should we..." Azana wondered, but Nall shook his head. "Nah, she's got it," he said, a broad grin spreading across his face as he stood, hands in pockets, and watched his cousin emerge into the world. Anne realized in that moment that she had unconsciously been expecting the new dragon to look like Nall, a creature not unlike a cat in shape and proportion, but for a pair of feathery wings. What emerged from the red egg, though, was nothing like that. This creature was perhaps twice as long and very slender, much more serpentine than Nall, with no real distinction between neck, body, and tail save for the positioning of four fairly short legs, more like the way dragons were depicted in Asian cultures. Her face wasn't cat-like either, but nor was it the face of a Chinese-style dragon. Instead, she had the classic European dragon's head, with muzzle, crest, and a pair of back-swept, gently spiraling horns. She did have wings, about halfway along her sinuous length, but they were bat-like, not feathered. The new dragon finished battering her way out of the shell of her egg, pushed the remnants aside, and sprawled full length on the hot coals in the bottom of the chest, faint plumes of steam rising where they boiled away the residual egg moisture clinging to her scales. In the bright sunlight streaming through the window, these glittered, not metallic like Bahamut's scales, but bright and with a curiously translucent depth. They were like thousands of minutely tessellated little jewels, each one a beautiful, rich blood red. "Oh," Azana breathed, her amber eyes wide with astonishment. "Spirits." Then, following some ancient cultural precept she might not even have been consciously aware had been instilled in her as a child, she fell to her knees before the chest and bowed her head, an instinctive obeisance, to one of the original firebenders. A short distance away, Korra glanced at Corwin, her eyebrows rising. "Okay, I was impressed when Nall hatched, but this... wow," she murmured to him behind a confidential hand. "I know, right?" Corwin replied, watching the scene with a fond smile. "Fire Nation girls." Korra blinked, then realized what he was getting at and smiled. "Oh yeah, right," she said quietly. "Course." Behind them, Utna glanced quizzically from one to the other, then leaned her head between theirs and whispered, "You guys are doing that thing again." "Remind me, I'll tell you later," Korra responded, a millisecond or two before Corwin could. After resting for a few moments, the hatchling dragon stirred, raised her head, and opened her eyes. Azana, still kneeling by the chest, met the creature's gaze with her own, awestruck and new. The dragon's eyes, like her scales, resembled gems. They were a clear and sparkling yellow gold, like fire opals. "You are so beautiful," Azana whispered. The dragonette blinked slowly back at her. Then the corner of her mouth quirked in an unmistakable little smile, revealing a number of very sharp-looking little teeth, and she spoke. "I was just thinking the same thing," she said. Her voice was mellow and not very loud, like a quiet teenager's, nothing like what Azana might have imagined the voice of a dragon would sound like, even if she had been expecting a hatchling to speak at all. Receiving no response to her opening foray, the dragon continued, "Hi." Then, looking around, she added, "Quite a crowd." Still grinning, Nall looked around at the dumbfounded little group, winked at Juniper, who seemed as taken by Azana's reaction as by the hatching itself, then nodded to Amy and said, "Mrs. Williams, a towel, if you please." "Huh? Oh," said Amy, and she stepped forward with the specified article. Nall crouched by the chest and, without regard to the coals, scooped up the tiny dragon carefully in his hands, then placed her upon it. "Oh, hello," said the hatchling, as the young Scotswoman carefully enfolded her in the towel and started gently rubbing away the last of the moisture. "That's nice," she went on, snuggling down. Glancing from Amy to Azana and back, she asked, "Are you all like this? Nobody told me," shooting an accusatory look at Nall with the last. Nall smiled and stroked her head. "Nalyu nik siut siarit, little red," he said fondly. "We meet at last. I'm your cousin Nall." The dragonette looked puzzled. Gesundheit, she said, and then quizzically, "What kind of a name is Nall? Can you even write that in dragon script?" Nall actually giggled at that, for reasons not immediately obvious to anyone but Corwin. "I don't use my draconic name among humans," he explained. "Whether you do is up to you, of course." The little dragon frowned thoughtfully. "Well, people have to call me something." "What about Ruby?" Nall suggested. But his cousin rolled her eyes at that, emitting a snort that brought with it a little puff of flame and a surprised sound from Amy. "That's so obvious," said the young red. Anne nodded agreement. "You're a darker red than that anyway," she pointed out. "You're more like a garnet." The dragonet turned to regard the young human thoughtfully for a second, then smiled. "Yeah, that'll work." Then, craning her serpentine neck in an attempt to look past Azana and Nall, Garnet went on, "Right, so where's the baby? I distinctly remember something about a baby." "Oh, right," said Amy. "Here." She carefully crossed the room, drawing all the others from near the chest along with her like iron filings after a magnet, then knelt at the bedside. "Hey, Annabelle," she said with a quiet smile. "Here's another new friend to see you." Garnet wriggled partially free of the towel and reached her snout toward the infant, who was regarding her with that same look of intense, vaguely bemused curiosity Corwin had registered the night before. The tiny dragon and tiny human examined each other for a few moments, while the adults tried not to crowd around, but watched the scene intently, some holding their breath without realizing it.
"Drem your look, Sovngarde Sekir," said Garnet, her voice hushed and serious now. "Zu'u Yolvalok."
Reaching closer, she touched her forehead to Annabelle's and went on,
"Fenkos hin span Sebrina."
Though any of them who knew anything about human newborns was well aware that it was far too early for that, several of the adults could have sworn Corwin and Anthe's baby daughter took that intelligence, whatever it may have meant to one who couldn't speak Draconic, on board with a certain grave focus. Then, with a delighted sound, she attempted, unsuccessfully, to put the dragon's head in her mouth.
"Ack!"
Garnet blurted, twisting away from her human companion's tiny hands. As she readdressed her strategy, coiling her body around the infant's, Cora failed to restrain a giggle.
"What?" Utina wondered.
"Oh, just remembering days gone by," Cora replied, casting a significant glance at Corwin and Nall. The former coughed, reddening, while the latter rolled his eyes and took a theatrical half-step away from him. Most of the well-wishers dispersed at that point, congratulating the new parents one last time and filtering away to various other pursuits, until the three and Cora were left by themselves with newborn and hatchling. As she followed Kate and Anne out, Azana hesitated, then turned back and lowered herself to one knee by the bed.
"Aw, are you leaving?"
said Garnet drowsily from her new station.
"I was just thinking I'd like to look at you for maybe a couple more hours."
This time it was Corwin's turn to snort and glance significantly at Nall, who looked frownily away, and Cora, who giggled again.
"History repeating, eh?"
said Cora, to a nod from Corwin, a cough from Nall, and a puzzled look from Utna. Azana's cheeks went a bit pink, but she put it aside and bowed her head again, saying in a reverent murmur,
"Thank you, honored dragon. I'm greatly blessed to have witnessed what I've seen today."
Garnet smiled lazily at her.
"What's your name?"
My name is Azana.
"Well, Azana, it was my pleasure, believe me," said the dragon.
"Oh, hey, before you leave, you might like this." So saying, she raised her head clear of the bedclothes, drew breath, and then breathed out a short cone of fire, sparkling and scintillating in a swirl of colors Anne had never thought of fire coming in. Watching the scene, the teenage samurai felt somehow as though she'd just opened a door and glimpsed a tiny part of the machinery that ran the universe. And Azana, sitting so near that the flames cast glittering reflections in her eyes, looked as if the heavens had winked at her. Looking at the young firebender's stunned expression, Korra quipped, could someone help Azana get to the ferry, please?
We're heading that way anyway, said Kate, smiling.
Yep, said Anne, cheerily taking Azana's arm as her slightly dazed-looking teacher rose, stammering out a nearly inaudible thank you to the dragon and last congratulation for the others.
Come on, Sifu, this way. See you guys later.
After seeing them off, and Nall and Amy with them, Uchina returned, pulled up a chair next to the bed, and sat down, putting her feet up on the corner of the mattress. Corwin had by this time gotten onto the bed itself opposite her, watching with an enigmatic little smile as Annabelle and Garnet dozed in Anthy's arms. So, said Uchina, as Korra sat down Indian fashion on the foot end of the bed, what was the deal with Azana there? She's a firebender. Corwin and Korra began at the same time. They glanced at each other. Corwin smiled and made a be-my-guest gesture. The dragons of this world were the original firebenders, the beings Azana's ancestors learned the art from. Korra went on after a moment to regather her thoughts. People all over the world have venerated them for centuries, but in the Fire Nation, before the Hundred-Year War, they were especially revered. Rare people, including my predecessor Roku, were able to commune with them and have them as companions, as I've always done with polar bear dogs like Neri. She looked more closely, making sure Garnet was asleep, then sighed glumly. Unfortunately, after Roku died, the Fire Nation nearly exterminated them. It turned into this bizarre firebending machismo thing during the war. Kill a dragon and prove you're more powerful.
What a tragic, senseless thing to do, said Anthy, sounding faintly shocked.
Korra nodded. Everything Fire Lord Sozin did was tragic and senseless. He and his son and grandson between them did this world so much harm. I'm the third Avatar since he came to power, and the mess still isn't entirely cleaned up. Hell, it may never be, not entirely. Those guys were special with a capital spesh. She sighed again. Anyway, the only reason dragons aren't extinct in Dicho today is because certain groups of people, who I will not mention by name, did their best to keep the last firebending masters alive. They're still at the top of the endangered species list. Even I can't get any information on where they're living now without a damn good reason. The only creature that's rarer than dragons in Dicho these days would be lion turtles, but they're in a classification all their own, and ever since we got global satellite coverage, it's made it easier for conservationists to keep track of them and to adjust shipping lanes so they aren't disturbed. She thought about it for a second, then added, well, lion turtles and Milo, there's only ever going to be one Milo, and it's best to keep the shipping lanes away from him, too, but for different reasons. So watching a dragon hatch was like seeing a vision out of ancient history, Uchina mused. Korra nodded. More than that, in Azana's case, she's from the actual Fire Nation, not descended from colonists or expats, and she comes from an old, old military family. Two of them, actually. On her mother's side in particular, they've been firebenders for generations, since long before Sozin's time. She'll have been raised on the stories of the ancient masters, the adventures of Avatar Roku and Fang, all that stuff, and been told 1,000 times since she was little that she would never, ever see one alive. Utrina nodded, understanding, as Cora went on. And then, suddenly, she was not just watching, but helping one be born. And in return, she got a look at the true fire, which is something maybe a dozen firebenders currently living have ever seen. The Avatar grinned, recovering her good humor at the memory of the look on Azana's face. Pretty special day. I hope Juni-chan's willing to guide her all the way back to her apartment. Left to her own devices, she's liable to wander in front of a truck or something. Corwin snorted. Cora glanced a question at him, and he grinned and replied, I suspect Anne's more than willing to go anywhere Azana might need or want to go. Utrina chuckled and agreed, Yeah, she goes for the elegant, snappy dresser type. Cora looked none the wiser for a second. Huh? Oh. Then she shook her head with a little smile and said, Well, I suppose that'll be motivational. Azana will keep it professional, though. Anne's too young for her anyway. For now, Corwin agreed thoughtfully. Then he shrugged and said, Ah, well, what is. He might have gone on, but there was a quiet knock at the open door just then. Looking up, he saw Jinora and Iki standing in the doorway, smiling. Good morning, Grandmaster, Master Iki, said Anthy, gesturing for them to enter. Please, come in. Excuse us if we don't get up, she added with a wry smile. Of course, said Jinora as she crossed the threshold, her sister right behind her. No, please, all of you, stay where you are, she said as Corwin, Utrina, and Cora all made to rise. The Apsara Lama declines to stand on ceremony, said Iki with a devilish grin. Where's that girl from the Tribune who's been following you guys around, Corwin? This is some real news for her to report. Jinora shot her younger sister a half-hearted glare, then sighed and turned back to the new parents. I didn't have a chance to extend them in person last night, but please accept my congratulations, she said. All of you. Then, smiling in a warmer, more human way than she had before, she said, Your daughter's beautiful. Corwin blinked to hear someone else pronounce the phrase. Anthy smiled fondly at her sleeping offspring and agreed, She is, isn't she? In olden times, Iki put in, there would have been a lot of drumming and chanting at this point, but do you know, we found that such things rather tend to upset newborns. So we tend to skip them these days. Utrina chuckled. Thanks for that. Annabelle stirred, half waking, but it was only to fumble around until one of her hands found Garnet's smooth, gleaming scales. Once she'd accomplished that, she went almost immediately back to sleep. She's a quiet one, at least so far, Jinora observed. That's unusual for this place, even with the drumming and chanting omitted, she added with a wry glance at Iki. Air nomad babies tend to be loud. I think that's my late mother's gift, Anthy replied. For her people, silence is an important survival skill. The Grandmaster lowered herself smoothly into Seiza at their bedside, her movements, as always, betraying no sign of her great age. Meeting Anthy's eye, she asked, May I? Please, said Anthy, nodding. Jinora reached out and very gently touched Annabelle's forehead with one hand, bowing her own head over the child. Annabelle stirred, murmuring, but didn't quite wake, as Jinora said softly, Welcome to our world, little one. Your family is a peculiar lot to this old woman's eyes, but no one can doubt their love for each other or for you. And in the end, that is all that matters. The blessings of the air spirits upon you. Wherever you go in your life, whatever you do or see or become, may the wind always bring you home again. After a moment's silence, Corwin said quietly, "Thank you, Jinora." The elderly airbender smiled at him, knowing that he wasn't just thanking her for the blessing, but for the remarks preceding it, for letting them stay in her father's house, for welcoming them to the island in the first place, for accepting what was. She knew all that, and he knew she knew it. Nothing more needed to be said, and so she left it all unspoken, and replied simply, "You're welcome, Corwin." Then she turned back and regarded the sleeping infant for a few more seconds, her expression kindly thoughtful. When she rose to her feet, she turned to Cora and asked her, "Have you told them?" Cora blinked at her. "Told them? Oh, no, sort of waiting for the right moment," she said, a trifle aggrieved. "Moment for..." Uchina prompted. "Your daughter's chi is very strong," Jinora said, which Uchina wasn't really sure was an answer, but seeing Anthe's nod and Corwin's thoughtful look, she held her peace and let the airbender talk. "I can sense it because I've devoted my life to the study of vital energies, spirit and human alike, how they flow and interact, what we can do with them, and what they do with us." Nodding toward the Avatar, she went on, "Cora can sense it because she is the Avatar." Cora rolled her eyes and muttered, "Yeah, no lifelong study here." Jinora gave her an arched eyebrow and cleared her throat ostentatiously, then turned back to Anthe and continued, "As such, I think it's very likely Annabelle will be a bender." Uchina blinked. How? Jinora shrugged. "Who knows? I very much doubt anyone has ever been born a bender who didn't have at least one parent from Dicho before." She went on with an indulgent smile. "But as ever with you three, it's a brave new world." "Do you know what she's likely to be a bender of?" Anthe wondered, regarding her daughter thoughtfully. "No idea," Jinora replied cheerfully. "It's rather exciting. She probably won't manifest any really noticeable abilities until she's at least able to walk." "I was 4, Cora put in. "Yes, but you've always been a slow learner, Cora," said Jinora with a serene smile. Cora half grinned, half scowled at her. "One of these days..." "You will stop opening doors for me that way?" Jinora wondered. "I hardly think it likely." Cora raised a finger as if to object further, then subsided with a muted, wordless noise. Iki slipped up next to her and patted her affectionately on the shoulder, whispering, "Welcome to my actual entire life." "At any rate," Jinora went on to her now quietly snickering guests, "when that stage is reached, be on the lookout for flying rocks." "Or for bath time to suddenly become much more interesting," Cora noted, her momentary, mostly feigned dudgeon over with. Uchina looked from one of her spouses to the other, then at their daughter, then at Jinora, and said a little awkwardly, "Not for the first time in the last couple of days, I'm not sure how to react." "That's perfectly normal, Uchina," Jinora told her kindly. "Every parent's reaction to this news is unique. Some are thrilled, some are scared." "Mine were pleased, sort of," said Cora. "I mean, they were happy when I told them I could bend, but Dad was a little nonplussed when fire was involved." She chuckled wryly. "I didn't understand the look he gave Mom for years." It took a second for that to sink in, but they were all still giggling about it a moment later, when there came another knock at the door, and the tall, elegantly robed figure of Chief Civil Servant Chin appeared on the threshold. "Good morning," he said.
I hope I haven't come at a bad time.
Not at all, Master Chin. Do come in, said Anthy.
Chin beamed at her and bustled into the room.
Thank you, Lady Anthy.
Bowing first to her, then to the three women who stood by the side of the bed, he addressed them politely in turn.
Your Holiness, Master Iki, delighted to see you again. Avatar Korra, I trust you're well?
Then he turned to Utina and Corwin, his beaming smile unchanged, and went on,
And our mystery couple, of course. The Tribune's people have been badger-moling my staff relentlessly for any information we might have on you.
With a twinkle in his eye, he polished his spectacles on an immaculate red silk handkerchief, and continued in a cheerfully didactic tone,
But, of course, it is the strict policy of the United Republic Office of Records and Vital Information to disclose nothing whatever except through proper channels, which they, naturally, can never be bothered to follow. And thus our traditional impasse persists for, I believe, the 157th consecutive year.
He popped the spectacles back on, folded the handkerchief fastidiously, and put it away, then bent to smile at the baby in Anthy's arms.
And this must be Annabelle.
Have you come to register her birth record? Korra inquired.
Yes, indeed, said Chin. Oh dear, where are my manners?
He bowed again, first to Utina, then to Corwin.
Maximilian Chin Yongmin the 17th, Supreme Civil Servant to Their Excellencies the President and Senate of the United Republic of Nations, and Hereditary Chief Bureaucrat to the Celestial Emperors of the Western Reaches, at your service.
And with that, he removed from his back a dark-stained, beautifully made wooden pack that turned out to be a sort of portable secretary with shoulder straps, placed it on the end of the bed, and began to unpack a surprising amount of kit from within it. Documents in expensive-looking dark card folders, an inking pad and roller, adhesive wafers, paper-wrapped gold foil, and a pliers-like sealing device. Annabelle complied without comment as her hands and feet were inked, printed, and cleaned with fastidious care by the fussy but competent hands of the bureaucrat. But even she, the quietest baby the Central Air Temple had ever seen, drew the line at the blood sample. At the sound of her wail, Garnet snapped awake, dismayed to be roused by sounds of distress. The little dragon wrestled herself free of the bedclothes, rearing up in furious confusion.
What? I'm awake! She declared, looking around.
Spotting the startled civil servant, bending over her crying charge with syringe in hand, she recoiled, baring her tiny fangs.
Have it, thee, varlet!
Whoa, easy there, champ, Uchin declared as Garnet spat a small bolt of fire at Chin.
The bureaucrat jumped back, instinctively raising his free hand to shield his face with one broad sleeve of his official tunic. The fire splashed against the fabric and dissipated, failing to take hold, as Corwin reached over and pinched Garnet's snout shut with thumb and forefinger. Garnet objected angrily.
What did I miss?
Asked the voice of Rory Williams from the doorway.
Oh, just Garnet taking exception to official procedure, Corwin replied, gesturing him into the room with a jerk of his head.
Then, turning back to the restrained dragonet, he said sternly, Don't set government officials on fire.
Nurr.
Garnet growled.
Are you all right, Chin? Korra asked.
I'm fine, thank you, Avatar, Chin replied with aplomb. He brushed a few traces of soot from his sleeve. That was unexpected, but one is always prepared to deal with obstreperous firebenders in my line of work.
Bending to address the still growling Garnet while Anthy soothed Annabelle, he doffed his cap and went on,
I apologize for startling you, honored dragon. Your young friend is quite unharmed, I assure you. I had only to cause her a moment's pain. Regrettable, but necessary.
Garnet blinked at him, apparently surprised to be addressed in such a cordial fashion,
Corwin released her snout with a warning look, whereupon she shook her head, a bit flustered, and subsided with a grudging,
"Well, don't let it happen again."
"Another sample won't be required," Chin promised, filing the one he'd acquired away in his secretary. "There are certain inborn conditions that are easily treated at this stage of life, but they must be caught very early," he explained. "The Republic Medical Services Laboratory will tell us all we need to know within a day or two. Not that I anticipate any troubles with a child as healthy as this," he added with a smile. Then, rummaging within the secretary, he went on as if to himself, "You'll also need to complete a 47C/WO, free-range dragon identification and census form. I hope I have one in here today."
"Oh, now I know you're just making it up," said Cora. Chin looked up from his work with an affronted frown.
"Please, Avatar," he said, and then, to her considerable surprise, he produced the exact form he'd been talking about.
It took him mere minutes to process the remaining paperwork, logging Annabelle's birth and Garnet's hatching for the official records of the United Republic of Nations. While he finished the documents, Jinora settled on a corner of the bed, regarding mother, child, and dragon with a thoughtful smile as the latter two settled back to sleep.
"We have one other small gift we'd like to extend," she said, looking from one parent to the other to the third, then glancing at Iki with a little nod.
Iki grinned and picked up the thread.
"You were already welcome on the island at any time. I hope you knew that. But as your first child did us the honor of being born here, Jinora and I would like to make her a citizen of the Air Commonwealth, if you agree."
Anthy glanced from one of her husbands to the other, polling them with a look, and then smiled.
"Thank you very much. We'd be delighted, of course," she said. "But may I ask, what does that entail, Master Iki?"
"Well, not much, really," Iki admitted. "It's mainly a symbolic gesture. We air nomads don't claim any sovereign territory of our own. Even this island is technically part of Republic City, though under the arrangement we have with the United Republic, our own laws and customs take precedence here. The other air temples around the world exist under similar agreements with whichever nation they're in."
Nodding toward Chin and his papers, Jinora said, "As such, Annabelle is already a citizen of the United Republic, by virtue of having been born here. That means she's eligible to hold Republic identity documents. Not that such a thing would be of much use in the big universe," she acknowledged with a little smile. "In practical terms," she went on, "our offer means that, if she wants it, she'll be able to obtain an air nomad passport as well."
"And there's one nice thing about having one of those," said Iki cheerfully. "You can go anywhere in Decho you want, anytime. No visa applications, no border controls, no questions asked. They can't even look in your luggage."
Jinora nodded. "It's an air nomad's sacred right to wander this world at will. International law has been very clear on that matter since it was first properly codified during the Republic's founding."
Utrina smiled.
"That's handy."
She switched places with Corwin, sitting next to Anthy as he rose to stand by the bed, and stroked Annabelle's hair gently.
"Zeta Cygni, the United Republic, the Air Commonwealth, Asgard. You're going to have more nationalities than you have parents," she told the child cheerfully.
"Her passport's going to be an inch thick," Corwin agreed.
Then, turning to Anthy, he said, "This seems like as good a time as any."
Anthy nodded. "I was just thinking the same thing," she said.
"What did I miss?" Cora wondered.
"Nothing yet," said Corwin. "But Anthy, Utrina, and I have been talking about it off and on for the last couple of days, and
Well, we're going to see about getting ourselves a place somewhere in Republic City. We won't be around all the time, obviously. Lots of other stuff going on, but, you know, maybe a month or three a year?
Cora's cerulean eyes went wide. Are you serious?
Sure I'm serious, Corwin replied. If you think you can stand having us around that much, he added with a wry grin.
Cora stared at him for a couple of seconds. Then, with a delighted cry, she jumped into his arms, her own going around his neck, in a gleeful, feet-off-the-floor hug.
I guess she likes that idea, Corwin observed over her shoulder to Uchna.
I guess so, Uchna agreed dryly.
Honestly, you guys, Cora said. She turned him loose and bent over the bed to put an arm each around Uchna and Anthy, then kissed Annabelle on the head.
That's the best news I've had in, well, quite a while. And it's not even my birthday.
Well, under the circumstances, we can hardly expect you to come to us, Anthy pointed out. Besides, this is Annabelle's homeworld now, she added with a fond smile. We wouldn't want her to grow up not knowing it.
There, said Chin, completing his work with a flourish. Official copies made, everything ready to go on file back at headquarters, he went on, closing up his portable secretary.
For your records, Your Holiness, he said, handing one of his elaborate folders to Jinora.
And this, he said, presenting an ornately capped and ribboned scroll to Anthy with a deep and courtly bow, is your copy of the official birth record. Your daughter is now a citizen of the United Republic of Nations and a free woman of the Commonwealth of Air Nomads and Air Acolytes, with all the privileges thereunto appurtenant, he concluded formally.
Thank you very much, Master Chin, said Anthy, her twinkling smile putting the lie slightly to the gravity of her response.
Chin smiled in return, then shrugged his secretary onto his back.
I must get back and file these, he said, reaching back over one shoulder to tap the case.
Bowing again, hands in sleeves, he said, A pleasure. May all your days be excellent ones.
What a charming man, said Anthy thoughtfully once he'd gone.
For your information, Rory said, crouching by the bed with a smile for mother and daughter, I ran the same scans the National Lab will be doing last night, and everything's fine. You were all pretty well out of it by that point, and there was nothing to report. So I decided not to pester you with it just then.
His smile becoming a touch rueful, he added, I'm not licensed here, or indeed anywhere, at the moment, so it's just as well to have official confirmation anyway.
Anthy smiled and touched his arm.
Thank you, Doctor, she said. You must tell me how you came by your training sometime. I'm sure it's a long and convoluted story.
It is that, Rory agreed. Then, straightening up, he said with exaggerated casualness, Well, I must go and find Amy. At the moment she's wandering round unsupervised on an island full of monkish young boys. The mind recoils in terror. For the boys.
The others chuckled and bade him good day. As he left, Anthy raised a hand in a wave, then looked down and said cheerfully, Oh, is it that time again already? As Annabelle woke and began hunting for sustenance.
Oh, this was not in the briefing, Garnet remarked dubiously, hiding her head in the covers as the process got underway.
Corwin, may I have a word? Jinora asked quietly.
Sure, Corwin replied, letting her draw him off to the other end of the room.
I'm pleased to see that the three of you have taken my concerns to heart, she told him, her voice low. I hadn't expected you to take action so quickly. In fact, I must say, If you intended to act on your plans during this visit, you've left it rather late.
We do our best work on the spur of the moment, said Corwin with a grin. Particularly Utina and me. Anthe's generally a little more deliberate. He turned his head and regarded the cheerfully domestic scene by the bed, where Cora and Iki were pitching in to help Utina, dismayed but game, get to grips with certain aspects of routine infant maintenance.
That's my daughter, he observed for about the 100th time that day, though not nearly all of them out loud.
He turned to Jinora and gestured vaguely.
That's my daughter over there, Jinora.
The elderly airbender nodded, smiling.
Yes, Corwin, she said gently. I know.
Corwin turned and looked back again.
I have a daughter, he said for a further time.
Then he faced Jinora again and asked,
Does this wear off at some point? Because I have to be honest, it's freaking me out a little.
Jinora's smile became slightly indulgent.
Not really, she said, but it does eventually become somewhat less intense.